From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Richard Goodwin was a speechwriter for Presidents Kennedy and Johnson. In his new memoir about the 60s, Goodwin goes public about concerns he never revealed before. On today's Fresh Air, Richard Goodwin describes the paranoid behavior he says Johnson exhibited in the White House. Also today, we meet Darlene Love. She sang lead on some of Phil Spector's biggest girl group hits, like He's a Rebel, Not Too Young to Get Married, and He's Sure the Boy I Love. Now she's back with a new solo album. Jazz pianist Dick Hyman is back on our weekly performance spot, this time playing the music of Errol Garner. And critic Ken Tucker reviews Gates of Heaven. Errol Morris's quirky documentary on pet cemeteries is now out on home video. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Richard Goodwin was at the center of national politics in the 1960s, in the White House with John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. Goodwin has written a political memoir about the decade titled Remembering America. His most controversial memories, memories he was reluctant to share until now, relate to President Johnson's behavior in the White House. Goodwin says he watched Johnson exhibit increasingly irrational and paranoid behavior and lose control of his political skills. Richard Goodwin first entered politics as John Kennedy's assistant speechwriter during his presidential campaign. He then became one of Kennedy's advisors on Latin American affairs. Goodwin coined the term Alliance for Progress and helped establish that program. As a speechwriter for President Johnson, Goodwin came up with the phrase the Great Society. Goodwin opposed Johnson's increasing escalation of the Vietnam War and left him in 1965. He later worked on Eugene McCarthy's presidential campaign, and then he switched to Robert Kennedy's campaign. But after Kennedy's assassination, Richard Goodwin left politics. According to Goodwin, President Johnson had many eccentricities. The first time he called Goodwin in for a meeting, the meeting was held in the bathroom with the president sitting on the toilet. Goodwin has described this as a mysterious test.
I viewed it as the action of a really rather colorful, eccentric fellow. I also viewed it as a kind of a test. He wanted to see how you would react, whether you're able to hold on to your emotions or stability in a situation like that. To tell you the truth, it didn't bother me. I'd been in the Army. You know, I'd seen people on the toilet before. I didn't have any particular, except that it was unusual because he was President of the United States. But he told me a story at that time about another White House, one of those effete Kennedyites, as he called them, who had come in when he was on the toilet, and Johnson had said something, and he didn't hear the man's reply, and he said, "Would you come closer?" He said, "You know, that fellow just backed right up to me." He said, "You'd think he'd never seen anybody perform in bodily functions before. It makes you wonder how he got along so well in the world."
So you think this was maybe a test to see if you were effete or not?
Well, I think it was a test to see whether or not you were able to keep your balance under a very unusual situation, and also whether you would tend to, how would you react to it? I mean, he was always, there was an undercurrent in Johnson, always, who felt that Easterners and Harvards, those Harvards as he called them, and looked down on him as a rough, ill-educated Texan, and he was trying to see if he could elicit that kind of a reaction by putting people in what, for some, I guess, was a rather extreme situation, which I didn't view that way.
When you went to work for Lyndon Johnson, he told you that he was going to pass all those bills that you cared about. He told you that Kennedy never really understood the Congress, and he did. Did he not respect Kennedy as a politician? I should say here, he also said that that he believed that all that charisma stuff was really a bunch of bull when it came to working Congress.
Well, I think Johnson, when he was vice president, of course, regarded his position as being rather humiliating and embarrassing, being lost in the glamour of what later was to be known as Camelot. I mean, Kennedy always tried to treat Johnson, I think, with respect and give him things to do. Robert Kennedy, on the other hand, I think, did not like Johnson, and Johnson knew that. But I think it was very hard for Johnson, when he became president, to live under, as it was for Nixon, who often talked about it later on, to live under the shadow of the kind of aura of glamour and everything that had come to surround the Kennedy administration. And I think Johnson set out to deal with that in the way he could most effectively, that is, through his performance. And in his first 2 years as president, I mean, he got more liberal legislation, progressive legislation through the Congress than at any time in the United States since the early days of the New Deal, since World War II. And he also did more for the cause of civil rights than any president since Abraham Lincoln. So there was some truth in what he said about his own ability to perform, but there always was over him. And I guess something that Nixon and others always had to deal with was the kind of aura that surrounded the, and still surrounds to some extent, as we can see, the Kennedy presidency.
My guest is Richard Goodwin, and he's written a memoir about his work in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations and in the Robert Kennedy and Eugene McCarthy presidential campaigns. The book is called Remembering America. Now, you also write about the increasingly irrational and paranoid behavior that Lyndon Johnson displayed. For instance, you say that he saw Bobby Kennedy as the leader of his enemies. What kind of conspiracy did he imagine Robert Kennedy was leading, as you understand?
Well, I think that in mid-65, as Johnson approached the decisions that would transform the Vietnamese war and the war in Vietnam into an American war to send large-scale combat troops, I think he alone among his advisors saw that this might destroy, as he said, the trumpets of war would destroy the, might destroy his own hopes and ambitions for the country, which I think were very great and idealistic, and which I believed in. At that point, I think he did become, there were periodic episodes of irrational behavior. And one of them you've just mentioned, which is he talked about Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King being enlisted together in a conspiracy to cause riots in the ghetto, to discredit his administration and to discredit his policies in Vietnam. At other times, he talked about it as a kind of communist conspiracy, being unwillingness to admit that his decreasing popularity in the country or that opposition to his policies was grounded in sincere and rational disagreement, he began to attribute it and to believe that it was the consequence of conspiracy. And those episodes, and they were only episodes because many times he was, much of the time, very firmly grounded in reality, began to worry not only me but other members of the White House staff, and we discussed it with psychiatrists, and I left at the end of 65, so joined the anti-war movement in 66. But I gather from what people have written in recent weeks in response to my book that these episodes continued and even accelerated through 66 and 67.
Well, I should say here that members of the press had called Bill Moyers to corroborate your what you have to say about Johnson's growing irrationality and paranoia. And what Moyer said was that he'll tell whatever stories he has to tell in his own words, in his own time, when he decides to write about it. Were you surprised at that reaction, and do you feel that your story has been corroborated?
I was not surprised at that reaction. I think Bill is entitled to tell his own story in his own words. Everything I say in that book, whether it's about him or about me or our conversations and our conversations with other people, is absolutely accurate and honest, and he has not denied it. I think that's true. In the Boston Globe recently, Charles Peters, the editor of the Washington Monthly, writes that he had a conversation with one of Johnson's oldest and most trusted aides in 1967, after I was deep in the anti-war movement, and complaining about the policies in Vietnam. The man told him, "I think the president's going crazy." So, I mean, I don't know what was happening then, but there are obviously other people, and there's Hugh Sidey in Time magazine himself has said that he and other members of the press felt that, yet nobody wrote it. And
why didn't you say anything at the time?
Well, as I said, finish that, that I regard as corroboration. Well, after I left the White House for a couple of years, there were several reasons. I have a lot of diary entries wondering about whether I should speak up about this. But first of all, of course, I'm not a doctor. I'm not a psychiatrist. I couldn't certainly prove that there was anything medically wrong with the President of the United States. Second of all, it was very doubtful in my mind that anybody would believe it if I did say it. They would regard it as a part of a politically motivated attack. We often said that when discussing this and while we're in the White House, that if we ever impaneled a jury of psychiatrists, that Lyndon would stand before them and say, "Those poor boys have just been misled after everything I've done for them, and they need help." And by the time we finished, the psychiatrist would end up committing us and sending him back to the Oval Office. But with all that, I think it may also, and with the fact that it would have caused us, I don't think that I could have proven the case. It still may have been a mistake And I am free to admit now, 20 years after the fact, that I may have made a very large mistake of judgment, or I may have been rather timid. When you see the kind of mini-storm that's been kicked up by revelations that are 23 years old and the war is over and the president's dead, you can imagine the kind of storm it would have caused at the time, and maybe I was a little afraid of that. Maybe it wasn't a mistake. I don't know, and that's the judgment, that's the judgment.
My guest is Richard Goodwin, and he's written a memoir about his work in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations and in the campaigns of Robert Kennedy and Eugene McCarthy. The book is called Remembering America. The paranoid and irrational behavior of Lyndon Johnson's that you describe, did that tie in, do you think, to his decisions about escalating the war in Vietnam?
Well, you know, in all the pages, 200 pages that I wrote about Johnson, I mean, it's too much too easy to skip over the enormous accomplishments of the man before the war. And it's obviously that he was, although many have had eccentricities and peculiarities, he was pretty much in control of things. I think it's the stresses of feeling compelled to make those decisions. And most notably, in mid-1965, when the decisions were being made for the first time to send large-scale American troops into combat. It was under those pressures of events that he couldn't control and he felt were threatening that I think that we began to witness these paranoid disruptions and incursions of Johnson's personality. And had that not happened, we might never have seen that, and he might have gone on to realize his great ambition, which was to out-Roosevelt. I think we have a case of an extraordinary man with a tragic flaw and history colliding with that tragic flaw. The result of that, of course, is classical tragedy, both for him and for the country, because the war, of course, did destroy the progress of the early 60s, or a lot of it, in any event.
Was there a turning point for you when you worked for Johnson in your views on how he was handling the war? Was there a turning point when you realized the war was escalating beyond control and that there were secret bombings and other things that the public did not know about?
Well, in mid-1965, I left the White House at the end of 65. When I left, I thought the war was still a retrievable error, that somehow we would negotiate our way out with some kind of jerry-built compromise as we did in Laos or there. And I did not, at that point, if anybody had told me that in a year or two there'd be 500,000 men in combat and 58,000 Americans would be dead and hundreds of thousands of Asians, that did not occur to me. But it did occur to me that what I was involved in, which was the Great Society and Civil Rights, had come to a halt, and that pretty much was while I left. During 1966, observing the conduct of the war and the steady escalation, I became convinced, both from observing from the outside and from what I knew of Johnson's own personality, that he had set out to win what was essentially an unwinnable war, and that meant unlimited escalation. And it was at that point, really, from outside the White House, that I first made a public break with Johnson, then ended up joining the anti-war movement and leading the political movements against him or participating in them in 1967 and 68.
When you told Johnson that you were leaving the administration, he begged you to stay, he tore up your resignation, and then he told you that if you insisted on leaving, he would draft you.
Well, I'd already been in the Army, luckily, so I don't think he could have drafted me. I'd served for a couple of years in the peacetime Army, and that was when I was in law school. Just before law school.
At the same time,
as Mike Dukakis. We were both in the Army around the same time. So I think that, it was at least half a joke. I don't know.
A joke or what?
I don't know. Uh-huh. I mean, he didn't draft me. So, you know, maybe he meant it. Maybe if he could have drafted. I think if he could have drafted me, he probably would have. But I couldn't think of any law under which he could draft me. I figured I remember we were walking along, and I said, well, if you draft me, why don't you at least make me a general? And he said, you don't want to be a general. He said, those heads are the ones that are going to roll. You better stay a private. So that was the end of that conversation, and I wasn't drafted.
Well, I want to talk with you about your work with the Kennedys, but first we're going to take a short break. Richard Goodwin is my guest, the author of Remembering America, which is a memoir about his work in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations and his work in the Robert Kennedy and Eugene McCarthy presidential campaigns. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Richard Goodwin is my guest, who's written a memoir called Remembering America, A Voice from the 60s. When you left Lyndon Johnson's administration, you went to work for Robert Kennedy. And as you pointed out before, Johnson really thought of Bobby Kennedy as being the leader of a conspiracy against him. Did you feel like you were going over into what Johnson would perceive as enemy territory?
Well, because there was no Robert Kennedy campaign until 1968, Robert Kennedy was probably the closest personal friend I ever had in politics. I got to know him very well after I left the White House in 1965, spent a lot of time with him, had great admiration for him. But I did know that as soon as I became associated with him in any way, which I took a trip to South America with him in 66, for example, that Johnson would undoubtedly perceive that as joining the camp of his enemies, which is rather ironic because at the time Robert Kennedy had no intention of running against Johnson at all. That didn't happen until 68. But yes, I realized that was going to happen. But once I broke on the issue of Vietnam and made a public speech against the war, which was widely reported at the time, in newspaper papers, I realized that, once you opposed Johnson on Vietnam, that meant you were an enemy, and that relationship was over. So I don't think it was joining Robert Kennedy, probably just, or being friendly with Robert Kennedy and working with him somewhat towards the same end, which was the end of the war, I'm sure aggravated that somewhat. But
I'm interested in what you thought Robert Kennedy's feelings toward his late brother were when you started working with Robert Kennedy. As you point out, Bobby Kennedy was frequently used as the hatchet man, as the person who would take the blame, take the fall for something that John Kennedy might otherwise have been blamed for.
Well, I think that was sort of his role in a way, especially when he was Attorney General. There's one story I have in there.
Was that willingly his role?
Well, I mean, he loved his brother, he admired his brother, and he felt that was the way he could be of service to his brother. That was fine. I'm sure it wasn't always fun for him to be out in front, but I remember sitting on the White House porch with John Kennedy and a group of Southern senators, and one of them turned to him and said, Mr. President, he says, I'm afraid I'm going to have to criticize you, and then there's civil rights. And John Kennedy looked up at him and says, can't you attack Bobby instead? And they all sort of laughed. But in a sense, that sums up. I mean, Bobby was out in front. He took the heat on a lot of things. But so did John Kennedy. I mean, he didn't try to blame his brother for the Bay of Pigs or for some of the other mistakes of the administration. But, I mean, I think Bobby was more than one. Bobby idolized his brother, admired him, and was absolutely, totally loyal and dedicated to him. And I think he played that role to some extent. He also had a very significant position of his own in the administration.
You were close to both of the Kennedys when they were assassinated, and I wonder what personal effect the assassinations had on you.
Well, I think the assassination of John Kennedy was like a thunderbolt, totally unexpected, something that came out of the blue. It was I go into it at some length, and it was an unbelievably, I felt that as a personal tragedy, but I think it was felt as a personal tragedy around the world. I mean, there's one story I have there about an American who was going through the Sudan and remote river, and he hadn't heard any news, and he got to a small store to pick up some provisions, and the man wrote out the bill in pencil, and he drew a small black border around it. The American asked him, why are you doing that? And he said, haven't you heard? He said, the greatest man in the world is dead today. And I think it was sort of the first worldwide mourning in history, and for me it was a time of mourning. Robert Kennedy's death was, in many ways, a much more personal thing. I was much closer to him personally. We were closer to being of the same generation. Not quite, but much more than with John Kennedy. I had spent a lot of time with him personally. I was with him when he died, both in the hotel and in the hospital. And to me, that was a great personal shock. And also, It happened in 1968, and it happened at a time when it looked like we might be able to overcome the damage that Vietnam had done to our hopes for the country. And then all of a sudden, Hugh King had died, and then a few months later, Bobby Kennedy died, and it was at that point I decided that I'd had enough of public life for a while. And withdrew and went to live in rural Maine and wrote about my experiences, but it was a personally devastating experience.
You say that you had become addicted to public life. Was it a hard addiction to break when you...
Well, I think bullets help break it, but I mean, I think that there's something intoxicating about being involved in public power and being involved in this. So you think, well, at least when you're in Washington, you think is the center of action. Later on, I came to realize that the center of action was with people like Betty Friedan writing The Feminine Mystique and Martin Luther King in Birmingham and Ralph Nader, and the great social movements of the 60s did not begin in the White House. They began with people like that.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. Do you think that a lot of people who are in the White House, who are in political power don't really realize the movements and the power of the movements that are happening outside the White House?
Absolutely. I think that it's always one of the dangers why the White House should be kept as open a place as possible, and instead of becoming the kind of sealed sanctuary that it can become, that it became under Johnson when Vietnam came along, that it was under Nixon, because the fact is it's an illusion to think you're running the country. The country is running you even more than you are, and as I said, the great social movements that have, which were the 60s, were the seedbed of so much change in this country, they had their beginnings a long way from Washington, or certainly a long way from the centers of government, and government then is forced to respond one way or another, hopefully, and responds constructively and positively to these movements.
Richard Goodwin is my guest, and we're discussing the subject of his new book, Remembering America, which is a memoir about his work in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations and his work in the campaigns of Robert Kennedy and Eugene McCarthy. You really got your start in the Kennedy administration as an assistant speechwriter working with Ted Sorensen during the Kennedy campaign. And I get the impression you are disturbed at how the role of speechwriters has changed over the years, that speechwriters used to be a lot closer to the policy making than they are now.
Well, I think that's what makes them effective. I mean, you go back to Roosevelt, people like Sam Rosenman, who worked with Roosevelt right up through Sorensen and Kennedy and through Johnson up until Nixon. The person who was a speechwriter, or the president's principal speechwriter or writers, was also deeply involved in the day-to-day formation of policy, went to cabinet meetings, worked closely with the president. The result was he knew what was happening. He had an idea what the president's thinking was, even what his cadences were, his voice cadences, his personal means of expression. And as a result was he was able to write speeches that really authentically reflected, even if in a heightened way, I mean, he had a job to do, the personality and the thinking and the values and the ideology of the man he worked for. When they finally moved the speechwriters out of the White House over the executive office building, I think this happened under Nixon, it became much harder to do that because you were writing for someone you hardly saw or hardly knew, and what you were doing was filtered through other aides, and therefore, I think if anybody compares the quality of eloquence in public life today with what it was in the 1960s, we can see the results.
When you were writing for Kennedy and Johnson, did you hear their voices in your head? Would you write for their cadences?
Very much so. I mean, you know, obviously that...
Can you compare a sentence or a paragraph that you wrote for Kennedy and Johnson and talk about why each fit the person you wrote it for?
Well, I don't have any text with me, but I think that, Kennedy was fond of alliteration and, one line that I wrote for him, I suppose it's lasted a little bit. Not much of this lasts for very long anyway. It's pretty transient stuff, but it's those who make peaceful revolutions impossible make violent resolutions revolutions inevitable. Now you see there that kind of apposition of phrases and everything that's characteristic of Kennedy, as we never negotiate out of fear, but never fear to negotiate, which is a line I didn't write. I wrote the first one.
A lot of parallelisms.
Parallelisms and appositions and that kind of thing. I think Johnson I mean, the most famous paragraph I think I ever wrote that Johnson used was which he said, "It's not just blacks, but all of us who must overcome the heritage of centuries of bigotry and injustice, and we shall overcome." He said that to a joint session of Congress. And Johnson's style was less convoluted, more simple, and straightforward. And it was more, that's the way Johnson thought and spoke. And it could be just as eloquent and forceful as Kennedy's. So that in a very, very different way, it was more a Roosevelt in tone. Kennedy had his unique kind of style.
You described Jack Valenti tallying up during one of Johnson's speeches the number of words per minute he got in and the number of interruptions for applause during the speech, and this divided into some kind of ratio. was this a typical way that Johnson...
Well, Johnson liked to keep track of the number of times he was interrupted by applause. It gave him some sense of how his audience reacted. I think it's probably perfectly legitimate. You know, it's at least as legitimate as television and radio ratings. He was providing, it was his own little rating service he was carrying around with him and from a live audience. Then, of course, he'd get the other ratings that came from people like you in broadcasting. But he did like to do that, that's right.
You spoke a little bit earlier about how the assassinations broke your addiction to public life. And I was wondering if it was in any way a relief to be out of what was called the establishment. And to be an individual voice and not the voice of an administration or the voice of a campaign.
Well, I think temperamentally I'm much more suited to that. Obviously, I found myself less and less suited to being a member of the establishment. I never was quite a member of the establishment. I was always kind of an outsider who was on the inside temperamentally. And I also found that the mores of bureaucracy, some of which I detail in the book, very difficult to deal with. My concept was that, I don't want to say it in a kind of a self-congratulatory way, but, you know, you just took the straight line was the shortest distance between two points, and you did it, and sometimes people got offended. So once I got out and I'm able to write on my own and I can say what I want, I'm fortunate enough to be able to have most of the things I write published, and I can speak out honestly and freely and suffer no retribution for it, and occasionally even make some money so that by doing it, so that I find that a much more comfortable way to be. In fact, if I had really had my full choice, I probably wouldn't be here at all today. I'd be home writing something. But everybody has to make a living.
Okay, well, I thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
Richard Goodwin's new book, Remembering America, A Voice from the 60s, is published by Little Brown. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning poet W.S. Merwin. He often writes about the beauty of the natural world and the consequences of man's desecration of it. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from World of Travel Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Piano tuning is courtesy of the Wilmington Piano Company. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from NPR member stations and the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Back in the early 60s, few people knew Darlene Love's name, but everyone knew her voice. She sang lead on He's a Rebel, He's Sure the Boy I Love, Not Too Young to Get Married, and other girl group hits produced by Phil Spector. Coming up, Darlene Love talks about her anonymous fame and her new solo album. Also, jazz pianist Dick Hyman is back in our weekly performance spot, continuing his history of jazz piano. Today he plays and discusses the music of Errol Garner. And critic Ken Tucker reviews Gates of Heaven, Errol Morris's unique view of pet cemeteries and their patrons. The film's just been released on home video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. One day after Secretary of State George Shultz accused Iraq of unjustifiable use of poison gas against its Kurdish minorities, the Senate charged Iraq with genocide and unanimously passed wide-ranging sanctions. But as NPR's Anne Garrels reports, Iraq continues to deny the charges.
At a news conference today, Iraq's Minister of State for Foreign Affairs repeatedly rejected accusations his country used chemical weapons against the Kurds. Dr. Hammadi suggested the charges were part of a conspiracy to undermine Iraq's position at the Geneva ceasefire negotiations. Hammadi said Iraq might permit independent observers, but only when the military campaign is over. State Department officials who have visited Kurdish refugees in Turkey say they show symptoms of poison gas, blisters, and vomiting. State Department spokesman Charles Redman once again warned relations with Iraq will suffer if Iraq does not renounce the use of chemical weapons. But U.S. officials admit the U.S. has little leverage, noting the Senate's economic sanctions will be more symbolic than anything because the U.S. does little business with Iraq. The U.S. is now exploring ways to raise the international pressure. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Israeli troops arrested 225 Palestinian activists in the occupied territories today. Officials say the crackdown smashed a Gaza Strip network accused of organizing subversive activities. The army said those arrested were linked to the mainstream Fatah faction of the Palestine Liberation Organization and were accused of 50 firebomb attacks on Arab shop owners who failed to heed strike calls. The suspects are also accused of planning attacks against Israeli army patrols. TWA hijacker Mohammed Hammadi severely beat at least one passenger on board a plane hijacked from Athens to Beirut in 1985. In a Frankfurt courtroom today, a passenger on the plane described the beating. Deirdre Berger has details.
41-year-old Kurt Carlson said he was beaten in the plane cockpit with a metal rod. Although his eyes were bound, he says he recognized Hammadi's voice, who kept repeating, "One American has to die." After several blows to his head, Carlson said he managed to move enough to avoid a last blow that he thought was meant to kill him. The brutality of the incident is in sharp contrast to Hammadi's version of events. Hammadi claims he was under orders to avoid any killing on the plane and says he tried to keep the other hijacker from murdering U.S. Navy diver Robert Seedham. Carlson also testified today that Hammadi and the other hijacker identified themselves as members of Hezbollah, a radical pro-Iranian group. Hammadi has denied the connection. Other passengers and crew members will be questioned during the trial, which is expected to continue into early next year. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger reporting.
With continuing unrest in Burma, the families of American diplomats there fled to neighboring Thailand today. 46 wives and children of U.S. Embassy staff members were among the nearly 250 members of the foreign diplomatic community who left the Burmese capital of Rangoon. Another 35 dependents of American diplomats plan to leave Burma this weekend. Dan Quayle today defended his admission to law school under a program designed to help minority students. The Republican vice presidential candidate reportedly used the influence of his wealthy newspaper family to enter Indiana University Law School. The dean of the law school at the time Quayle attended, said the special admission program was aimed at disadvantaged minorities. But Quayle's spokesman Jeff Nesbitt denied that the experimental program was aimed solely at the underprivileged. Pope John Paul II begins a controversial trip to Africa tomorrow. The pontiff will travel to five black-ruled countries in southern Africa, but will bypass racially segregated South Africa. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 5 points to close the week at 2068.81. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. This month, we've invited Dick Hyman to the piano as our performer in residence. Hyman specializes in the history of jazz piano, and today he's recreating the sound of Errol Garner. In addition to performing, Dick Hyman composes and arranges for movies. He's done the scores for Moonstruck, Zelig, The Purple Rose of Cairo, and played on the soundtracks for several other Woody Allen films. Dick Hyman developed his love of jazz as a child, listening to his older brother's record collection. When he was growing up, he was determined to learn how to play.
One way or another, I became familiar with traditional jazz piano styles at a very early and impressionable age. And I got the notion that if I learned how to play like each of them, I could eventually put these things, these styles together in my own individual approach to the keyboard. And I can still separate out the different elements that go into that approach and know where the sources, the roots, so to speak, were. For example, there was a man named Errol Garner, who was a wonderful pianist, wonderful jazz pianist. He died in the late 1970s. He was born in Pittsburgh. He had a unique way of playing the piano. He liked to strum with his left hand as though he were playing the guitar. With the right hand, he'd play so full at times it sounded like a big band. Big chords, big block chords with a lot of notes in them. Very fast octave things like that. A lot of repeated notes. And then in between these explosive kind of block chord and octave elements, he would have a single line sort of thing, almost like a saxophone playing. And he'd put them together with wonderfully alternating characteristics of driving and hard and then a little more relaxed, laid back. And often he used what musicians call rubato. He would play a little out of tempo in one hand, lagging behind the beat in one hand while the left hand kept the beat going like... So... I'll try to put these things together now in my approach to Errol Garner style and do a tune which, if Errol Garner were to be playing a nice standard jazz tune called Undecided, might come out something like this. Thank you. One time I actually played two pianos with Errol Garner, and all I can say was that I learned a lot about what the difference between my impression of his playing was and his own playing. But it was a wonderful, if somewhat humbling, experience, and I wish he were still with us. He was a great, great jazz pianist.
Next week, Dick Hyman plays the music of boogie pianists Meade Lux Lewis and Jimmy Yancey. This is Fresh Air. Darlene Love was one of the singers Phil Spector built his girl group sound around. Her records were much better known than she was. She sang lead on songs like He's a Rebel, Zippity Doodah, Today I Met the Boy I'm Gonna Marry, and He's Sure the Boy I Love. She was a singer with a backup group called The Blossoms when she met Phil Spector, but he recorded Darlene Love and The Blossoms under several names, The Crystals, Bobby Sox and the Blue Jeans, and Darlene Love. For years after leaving Spector, Love worked as a backup singer, but now she has a solo career and a new record. It's her first studio-produced solo album. In the first of a two-part interview, I talk with Darlene Love about recording those early hits.
See the way he walks down the street. That's the way he shuffles his feet. My hold his head up high when he goes walking by. He's my guy. When he holds my hand, I'm so proud. Cause he's not just one of the crowd. My baby always the one to try the thing they've never done. And just because of that, they say, hey, he's a rebel and you'll never be any good. He's a rebel.
I know the first song that you recorded for Spector was He's a Rebel.
Right.
You sang lead on it.
Yes.
But although you sang lead and The Blossoms backed you up, the song was recorded under the name of The Crystals, which
right.
had already had a few hits, one of the girl groups who had already had a few hits. Why did he record you under the name of The Crystals?
Well, him and The Crystals, I think, had fallen out at that time. They didn't want to fly to California for whatever reasons. Well, he just told them okay, and he just left them in New York and came out to the coast and decided to record this song because he was so... He had in him that this song was going to be such a monstrous hit, he didn't want to sit on it. So he just found the best person he thought he could to do the lead and do the backup and to put the record out, because Vicky Carr had a song, He's a Rebel, out also, and he was trying to beat her record out.
Well, why couldn't he call you Darlene Love and the Blossoms? Why did he call you The Crystals?
Well, at that time, he had the name The Crystals, and he had already had a little success with the name The Crystals already. They already had, I think, like two top 10 or top 20 records. So I guess he figured it would have been easier to break them with another record rather than starting out fresh with a new sound, new voice.
Your recording of He's a Rebel under the name of The Crystals rose to number one on the charts. Did you ever talk to any of the members of The Crystals about how they felt about that, having the name of their group with your voice on it?
Not until years and years later. Matter of fact, about 5 or 6 years ago, when I actually did run into one of The Crystals, who was one of the original girls who is still working today, Dee Dee. And she came up to me and told me that Phil Spector came back to New York after He's a Rebel was done and put their voices on it. I don't know. She was trying to make it seem like they were a part of it. And she was trying to tell me to stop telling people that I did it, which was very weird.
Uh-huh.
After 20 years later.
Well, how did you feel about it? Here it was, your voice, without any credit to you.
I didn't really feel one way about it or the other because I went in to do it as a recording session, you know, like many of the other things that I did that just weren't hits. Because I did a lot of other things like that, like He's a Rebel. It's just that those things that I did under other names were not hits.
Now, you also recorded He's Sure the Boy I Love under the name of the Crystals.
Right.
Then Phil Spector changed your name to Bobby Saxon Blue Jeans.
Right.
And under that name, you recorded Zippity Doo Dah and Not Too Young to Get Married. When Phil Spector asked you to record Zippity Doo Dah, did you think it was a very good idea?
No. I couldn't imagine what we were going to do with Zippity Doo Dah. Matter of fact, I asked Phil, I said, you mean that song about the Song of the South with Uncle Remus? And he said, yes, that song. I went, well, okay. But by the time we were like halfway through the song and we were realizing what Phil was doing to the song, it made a lot of sense, you know.
How did you realize what he was doing to the song? Would he play it for you, sing it for you?
Well, once he got into the arrangement of the song and the vocals kind of just fell into with the track. What you have to realize that we were very professional singers at that time at doing background. So when it came time to sing the song Zippity Doo Dah, we knew the song. And we just kind of fell into the rhythm of the song with the track.
Under the name of Darlene Love, you recorded Today I Met the Boy I'm Gonna Marry and Wait Till My Bobby Gets Home. Did you sing any differently knowing that it was going to be under your name? Did you know it was going to be under your name?
Well, He's Sure the Boy I Love was supposed to be a Darlene Love record because before we did He's Sure the Boy I Love, we had already became Bobby Socks and the Blue Jeans. We had Zippity Doo Dah out before He's Sure the Boy I Love, and he had signed Darlene Love. He had changed my name already, and he told me that that was going to be my next release. And I didn't know it wasn't my next release until we were in the car, and I heard it on the radio, and the disc jockey said, this is the Crystals' latest record, and they played He's Sure the Boy I Love. That's when I found out it wasn't a Darlene Love record.
Well, you must have been pretty angry hearing that, huh?
I was a little upset about that one.
Always dreamed the boy I loved would come along, and he'd be tall and handsome, rich and strong. Now that boy I love has come to me, but he sure ain't the way I thought he'd be.
You said before that you felt that Spector had you hold back when you were singing.
Mm-hmm.
What did you mean?
I have a very powerful voice. Matter of fact, it was funny sometimes when I had to do ad-libs, I would have to stand like, you know, 10 feet away from the mic to do the kind of singing that I did. Or if I would over-sing too much, Phil would take an earlier tape that I had recorded, and use that one rather than the more powerful voice that I was using.
Now, I understand that the Do Run Run, which you recorded, he later had another singer overdub. Is that
yes.
right?
Lala was the lead singer for the Crystals, and Phil had been playing this song for me, and I really liked it. We went in the studio and we recorded the song. What you have to understand, by then I was in the contractor field, but he also owned the name The Crystals, Bobby Sox and the Blue Jeans, and Darling Love. So I could really put a record out under any name. But I got mad at Phil because I knew he was Do Run Run was going to be a Crystal record. So we had a conversation about it after I had recorded it. And I guess so I wouldn't really get way out of line or out of pocket, he flew Lala in and put her voice on top of mine to make it seem like I wasn't the voice that was really on the record.
How did you find out about that after you heard it?
Well, I was in touch with all the studio people. I knew them very well. I knew most of the studio people at Gold Star Records before I had even met Phil. So they would tell me what Phil was doing.
You were known as the best singer in the girl groups. Did you think of yourself that way?
No, I never did. Because during that time, everybody, to me, was almost like sounding alike. My voice stood out in Phil Spector's ears, I think, because I had the more mature voice. And I think that came from the gospel singing, where the other people had not had any kind of professional training or sung in public, where I had been doing that in church and also in school.
Your voice, I think, was not only more mature, it was also more controlled.
Right, exactly. I would agree with that.
On our next show, I talk with Darlene Love about her life over the past 20 years since she parted with Phil Spector. This is Fresh Air. Let's look ahead to All Things Considered and check in with co-host Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
How are you? What story are you following?
Well, we're following the controversy over Iraq's alleged use of gas against the Kurds. Today, the Iraqi ambassador to Washington denied the State Department's finding that the Iraqis have been using gas. That's been reported by a lot of people who say they've witnessed it. Also, we talked to Fawad Ajami, a scholar of Middle Eastern history and politics, who said that actually it's the sort of thing that you could expect from the Iraqi regime. We have this evening a special report by Verta Mae Grosvenor. Also, it's about the town of Cotton Plant, Arkansas. When things got bad, people left for the towns. Now, once a year, they reverse that migration and go back to their old town.
Well, thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Director Errol Morris is currently receiving rave reviews from film critics for his new documentary, The Thin Blue Line. But over a decade ago, Morris made another highly praised film called Gates of Heaven. It was shown recently on public television, and it's now available on home video. Critic Ken Tucker has this review.
Gates of Heaven, made in 1977, explores the phenomenon of pet cemeteries, the people who use them and the people who run them, as well as the animals that are buried in them. Director Errol Morris fixes on a cemetery in Los Altos, California, where buried in 450 plots are the remains of pet dogs and cats, as well as snakes, rats, and monkeys. The Los Altos Pet Cemetery was founded by a large, stolid man named Floyd McClure. It's a place that caters to the needs and desires of its customers, such as this man, who talks about the family dog as if it had been his child.
Well, Christmas morning, in fact, this was just before his death, we all came down to open our presents. And they were all laid out in various sections around the Christmas tree. And we would hand each one of us a gift, particularly with my mother-in-law, or being the elder of the family, we'd bring her presents. Well, he lined himself up and couldn't wait, and he went right to the direction of where his packages were and started unwrapping them right in there, and they were not laid right out in the open, and he unwrapped his presents just like sharing with all of us there.
Errol Morris has said that one of the things he most dislikes about the vast majority of documentaries is that they become, quote, a bad species of journalism. With that in mind, Gates of Heaven goes much farther than a conventional documentary might in interviewing its subjects. Morris leaves in a lot of fascinating stuff that doesn't really fit his ostensible subject matter. There's an extended portrait, for example, of two brothers who work at the pet cemetery. The older one, Phil, is a failed insurance man who apparently had a mild nervous breakdown. He's come to work at the cemetery until some of his bigger plans pan out. Spouting a lot of business world jargon and positive thinking gobbledygook, Phil is clearly a desperate fellow who tries to feel superior to his younger brother, Dan, a shy gentleman in his 20s who uses his earnings from the cemetery to buy electric guitars and big amplifiers. When there's no one around the cemetery except him and the gravestones, Dan lets rip with a few cranked-up Jimi Hendrix-style guitar solos. As I said, this has very little to do with the surface of Gates of Heaven, and by conventional documentary standards, it throws the rhythm of the film out of whack. But these profiles have everything to do with Errol Morris's attempts to get under people's skins, and it's what makes Gates of Heaven a surprisingly moving, never condescending film. Also just out on video cassette is Moonstruck, the 1987 film that won Oscars galore a few months ago. The story of a Brooklyn widow and her extended family, this movie, directed by Norman Jewison, manages to transcend its ethnic screwball comedy framework to become a sweet yet smart romance. The film stars Cher and Olympia Dukakis, who both won Oscars, as well as Nicolas Cage and Vincent Gardenia.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore. When the world seems to shine like you've had too much wine, that's amore. Bells will ring, ting-a-ling-a-ling, ting-a-ling-a-ling, and you'll sing Vita Bella. Hearts will play tippy-tippy-tay, tippy-tippy-tay, like a guitarandella. When the stars make you drool just like a...
Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I continue my conversation with singer Darlene Love, the phantom lead singer on many of Phil Spector's biggest girl group hits. Darlene Love talks about her life since leaving Spector and her new solo career, which is about to get a boost from her new solo album. Also, jazz critic Evan Whitehead reviews a reissue featuring the music of Sidney Bechet. And television critic David Bianculli reviews Bill Moyer's World of Ideas. It's a new nightly half-hour interview show that debuts next week on PBS. So I hope you can join us. And we'd like to welcome a station new to Fresh Air, WGLT, in Normal, Illinois. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.